We often make use of imaginary examples called thought experiments. We illustrate points, establish principles, and try to clarify and persuade by putting thought experiments to use. This is a major way philosophers do philosophy. But can they really help us understand the real world? As it turns out, yes. Thought experiments have played a crucial role in the development of mathematics, philosophy, and science. As implausible as it may seem, reasoning a priori, comfortably from our armchairs, can actually teach us about the real world and even drive progress in physical science. This makes perfect sense in the realm of mathematics, but you might think, surely thought experiments aren't enough when it comes to the physical nature of things, how they'll behave in the real world. We need actual experiments. And you'd be right, generally speaking. You need to go out and look at the world to figure out how it works. But I want to discuss one thought experiment from Galileo that proves you don't always have to. You can use reason alone to draw interesting and true conclusions about the world. Most historians don't believe that Galileo actually performed the experiment of dropping two objects, a cannonball and a musket ball, from the Leaning Tower of Pisa. Of course, if you wanted to demonstrate that two objects of different weights fall at the same rate and reach the ground at the same time, you would want to go out and try it in the real world at some point. But in Galileo's work on motion, he doesn't report any empirical data. Instead, he makes use of a thought experiment, and in doing so, he undermines Aristotelian physics. Aristotle held that heavier objects would fall faster to the ground than lighter objects. Makes sense? If he was right, the cannonball would hit the ground before the musket ball. So imagine that we tied the cannonball and musket ball together. Would the new object fall faster than the lone cannonball, or would it fall slower? Well, obviously it would fall slower. If lighter objects fall slower, a lighter object tied to a heavier one should bring down the speed. The musket ball will act as a parachute, holding back the speed with which the cannonball is descending, so the two objects together should fall slower. But on the other hand, when we tie two objects together, we've made a bigger, heavier object. The two tied together are heavier than the cannonball alone. It's cannonball plus musket ball. And if heavier objects fall faster than lighter objects, the two tied together should fall faster than the cannonball by itself. So if we take Aristotle's theory seriously, the two objects tied together would fall both slower and faster than the cannonball falling alone. His theory, that heavier and lighter objects fall at different rates, leads to a contradiction. The musket ball, falling at a slower rate, should drag down the speed the cannonball is falling, and the two objects tied together are heavier than the cannonball, meaning it should fall faster. So what conclusion do we draw? Heavier and lighter objects fall at the same rate. That seems counterintuitive, but it must be the case that lighter and heavier objects fall at the same rate, since Aristotle's view leads to a contradiction. According to Professor Patrick Grimm, there are two crucial elements in a good thought experiment. Under clearly imaginable circumstances, a theory leads to a clearly unacceptable conclusion. In this case, a contradiction. If the circumstances are not really imaginable, either because they're incoherent or some other reason, then the thought experiment is about some other world than the one we live in, and perhaps no world that could even exist. If the thought experiment doesn't lead us to a clearly unacceptable conclusion, then it doesn't undermine the theory in question. And just to borrow a couple more examples from physics, Einstein's theories predicted time dilation, and to many, that was intuitively ridiculous. But it turns out time dilation wasn't the clearly unacceptable conclusion that some thought it to be. And the same could be said of Copernicus, who Martin Luther referred to as that fool who wanted to turn the whole of astronomy upside down. This is a serious limitation of thought experiments. It's oftentimes difficult to distinguish realistic from unrealistic circumstances, and it's very hard to distinguish acceptable from unacceptable conclusions. These two ingredients that make a thought experiment worthwhile, a clearly unacceptable conclusion under clearly imaginable circumstances, are hard to discern in practice. So eventually Galileo's thought experiment was tested, and on the moon no less. A feather and a hammer were dropped at the same time, and in the near vacuum, the feather and hammer hit the ground at the same time, at least in the Hollywood studio where they filmed the moon landing. So Galileo has been experimentally confirmed, but I would say we already knew he was right. Pure rational reflection can sometimes lead us to truths about the real world. But then there are ethical thought experiments, where thought experiments seem to be the most abundant and the least helpful. If you ask me, these short hypothetical scenarios are almost useless. They're often presented context-free, eliminating relevant detail, and in the course of probing our moral intuitions, they often include detail that we wouldn't have in the real world. In the end, we're discussing a hypothetical world vastly different from the one we live in. I suspect that the resistance to speaking about current events or real scenarios is simply that it's harder to do so. It's just easier to create an imaginary world where there are no real stakes, where we have more information about the consequences of our actions than we actually would, and less information about all that annoying context. But I say that if you want to defend torture, talk about actual instances of torture, not thought experiments about torture. If you have to create a world that doesn't exist to make your case, you don't have a case. And besides, I don't care what I should do in a world that I don't live in. As James Wilson writes, quote, "Overall, ethical thought experiments are, at best, fallible ways of constructing simplified models that map rather imperfectly onto the world as we experience it, and can distort as much as they illuminate." End quote. So should we give up entirely on moral thought experiments? Not necessarily. We could make use of them as long as we understand their limitations, which at this moment do not seem to be widely appreciated. There's a sort of only game in town argument to be made in defense of thought experiments. We're working with a flawed tool, but what's the alternative? I would say that in moral philosophy, it's, get this, talking about the real world. Why talk about runaway trolleys when there have been situations like this?
I want you to imagine that you are a surgeon. And you're a surgeon who suddenly finds himself in charge of a hospital in the middle of a disaster zone. You have 600 staff, you have 200 critically ill people. It's Monday morning. Monday morning, the city's electricity goes off, the water supply goes off. Temperatures rise in your hospital to 100 degrees. Tuesday, the sewer system starts backing up. The helicopters that were taking a few of your patients out are no longer coming. On Wednesday morning, the electrical backup generators that had kicked in on Monday go out. On Wednesday, you have no water, no running water, no electricity, none. Your elevators don't move, stairwells are black, you have no electricity, the temperature in the hospital is now over 100 degrees, sewers are backing up, you're down to about 100 critically ill people. You somehow get through Wednesday. Then on Thursday, you start hearing gunfire. City sheriffs, state police say you have to have the hospital evacuated by 5 p.m. And you have 100 people to deal with, 100 ill patients to deal with. And you're supposed to have them all out of there by 5 o'clock. And there's simply no way you're going to be able to get all of them out of there by 5 o'clock. So what do you do? You're faced with a number of serious moral questions. How long should healthcare workers have to stay in a hospital if people are going to die? And which of these 100 patients should receive what limited care you have in trying to get them out? The people that you leave who are ill and in pain, where do you draw the line between comfort care and mercy killing? And who's going to make all these decisions? When you have to decide who goes and who stays, how do you make that decision? What's the greatest good here? The number of people you save? The years of life you save? The best quality years? How do you make these decisions? This happened in New Orleans in 2005 at Memorial Hospital. At the last week in August, the first week in September. When they got back to the hospital, there were 45 bodies in the chapel. And the autopsies showed that quite a few of them had massive doses of morphine. and midazolam, Valium-like drug, doses that would be lethal.
My point is not that talking about the real world is a flawless means of arriving at moral truth. My point is that it's far less flawed than talking about a thought experiment. I would say fiction is far superior to thought experiments. In a way, thought experiments are just really, really bad fiction. But a serious limitation of talking about the real world, or high-quality fiction, is that the presentation of the real-world scenario might be so restricted and oversimplified that we end up back where we started. A drastically oversimplified account is no better than a thought experiment. On the other hand, we might end up writing War and Peace if we try to fully flesh out the context in morally relevant detail. But who said moral reasoning would be easy? To quote Wilson, "Even our best tools for ethical thinking are not very good. Humility should be the watchword." The best response to my case against ethical thought experiments is the work of Peter Singer. Singer uses thought experiments in his work, and there's one in particular that seems to make an impression on everyone.
I ask you to imagine that you're walking across some park that you know quite well, and in this park there's a shallow ornamental pond. But there is something going on, some splashing around in the pond. So you look closely and you see it's a small child, a toddler, who has fallen into the pond and is apparently in danger of drowning because it is too deep for a toddler to stand. So your first thought is, well, who's looking after this child? Where's the parents or the babysitter? Must be somebody. But you look around and to your dismay, there's nobody. In fact, there's nobody around at all except you and the toddler. So your next thought presumably is, well, this child appears to be drowning. Maybe I should jump into the pond and pull the child out, which I know I can do quite safely, no risk to my life. But I did just put on some of my best pair of shoes and maybe nice pair of trousers or whatever it might be, and they're going to get ruined if I rush into the muddy pond and I wouldn't really have time to take them off. So... is that a reason why maybe I don't have to save the child? Is it going to be okay if, because I don't want to ruin my shoes or my trousers, I just say, well, it's not my child. I didn't push the child into the pond. I'm in no way responsible for this child being in a dangerous situation. So I could just be on my way. Well, I saw some heads shaking already, and I'm glad to see that, because most audiences, when I do ask that question, say, no, of course, that would be totally wrong. That would be horrible to think that somehow your shoes or trousers outweigh a great danger to a child's life. You forget about that, forget about them, just jump in and pull out the child. And of course, I think that is the right answer, and I hope that is what we would all do. But the way that this relates to global poverty, of course, is that there are children in many developing countries in danger of dying right now. There are things that we could do to help them for something like the cost of an expensive pair of shoes or shoes in your trousers as well. And yet, most people are not doing it. And so if you're going to condemn the person who fails to save the child because he doesn't want to incur the expense of replacing the clothes, then don't you yourself have to at least donate the cost of a pair of expensive shoes and clothes to those organizations that are helping the global poor?
The reason I say Singer's work is the best counterargument is because he's effective. He's actually succeeding in changing the minds and behavior of those who listen to him. I think one reason the pond is not like other thought experiments is that it's pretty easy to see how it's analogous to our lives and very hard to argue that it's not, as uncomfortable as the implications may be. Singer has actually made the world a better place by reducing suffering, and he has literally saved human lives as a direct result of presenting his pond thought experiment. Many have changed their lifestyles, be it turning vegan or donating money they don't need, in order to save human lives. Because of his work, legislation has been changed in order to improve living conditions for animals. It should be noted that Peter Singer is the exception and not the rule. He's been uniquely successful among philosophers in producing moral philosophy that affects positive change in the real world. That's not the norm. Were I to make the case in favor of ethical thought experiments, Singer's work would be Exhibit A, and possibly the only exhibit. Thank you for listening. I've been Emerson Green, and I'll talk to you next time.